United States Attorney General. Mr. Soria, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. The primary issue before the court today is whether the Virginia receipt of stolen property qualifies as a crime involving moral turpitude. I think all the parties agree that typically to have a CIMT, you require two things: some degree of scienter and conduct that rises to the level of being vile, base, or depraved. In this case, the board has ignored its own precedential requirement of concerning both elements. And as this court has pointed out in Zarate and more recently in Lopez, it's not enough to look at some degree of scienter and decide that that satisfies the moral turpitudinous by itself. And so given that the board says in this case, if you have the knowing knowledge that the property is stolen, that makes it automatically qualify as a CIMT, that conflicts with this court in Zarate saying, we understand that traditionally the board in matter of Jurado Delgado has said that an intent to deceive is sufficient alone, and that was similarly upheld in a Fifth Circuit case. But the board has begun conflating its analysis of this. And so we would argue, Your Honor, that given that the board didn't consider whether the conduct itself rises to the level of vile, base, or depraved, that this court should remand so that the BIA can do that in the first instance.
The BIA can do what in the first instance? Be specific.
Consider whether the minimum conduct under the statute, Your Honor, rises to the level of vile, base, or depraved.
What about if they consider in the first instance what their prior precedent requires? Because you know the government says that's dicta.
Well, I think there's large parts of Jordan v. DeGeorge that I think are dicta, Your Honor. There's large parts of the BIA precedential history.
You know, you're addressing...
I understand, Your Honor.
Addressing the issue, I'm asking you why we don't send back to them to address.
Well, as this court has said in Zarate and Lopez, well, Lopez wasn't concerning the BIA, but that this analysis has been conflated. And so I think knowing that some degree of scienter isn't enough, that the board needs to reach that second prong, and their precedent has started to ignore that, Your Honor.
Of course, what the government says is what that precedent dicta means is... you look to whether there was a, they say you're reading permanently in before deprived, and those previous decisions jump. If somebody takes property and wanting to temporarily deprive it, that's enough, but not permanently. You don't have to show that.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think we're confusing the mens rea requirement with this, the intent to deprive, with the actual conduct. Because if you read the board precedent cases, especially the older ones, Matter of P, which, yes, it's almost 80 years old, it discusses in there that the conduct itself requires permanent deprivation. And that's the distinction that the board has always been able to make, both with joyriding in terms of degree of scienter, but the conduct itself. And so I think the board, in, like I said, in sort of conflating these things and mashing them together, they've said, oh, intention to deprive, and then they're also reading that into the conduct itself and not just the some degree of scienter.
You're on the short end of a 6-1 circuit split, aren't you?
I understand that, Your Honor, and Solis Flores definitely didn't help. But if you look at Solis Flores, I would point out two things. One, all the cases that they cite in Solis Flores, they specifically cite to that some degree of scienter. And as this court has recognized, that is not the full analysis that must be performed. And so I would argue if this court continues to follow its line of cases in Zarate and Lopez, the conduct itself has to be considered. And the minimum conduct here, you know, in Wolverton, we're talking about, you know, something worse than less than a penny. And also, again, because the conduct itself doesn't require a permanent deprivation, I don't know that that injury rises to the level. I mean, the reason we've always rationalized joyriding is we say, okay, well, the person got the car back. right? And so if we don't have, and I understand the government's point that, well, receipts of stolen property are a different category of offenses, but that's concerning the mens rea. If we're going to say that a community standard for morals is at the same level for different types of statutes, I think that level, that standard has to be the same, that threshold has to be the same.
Why doesn't this statute, why isn't the scienter required by this statute enough? I don't see really how the joyriding example maps on to this particular statute. Can you explain why that would even be a workable example there?
I think for two reasons. One, I think it's particularly vexing to immigration practitioners in general, Your Honor, that a shoplifting offense, you know, would qualify as a CIMT, but joyriding wouldn't, because I think stealing a car or taking it for, you know, a Ferris Bueller style ride, to me, is more morally repugnant and reprehensible. And I think that's why it's vexing for immigration practitioners.
Yeah, but our purpose is not to unvex practitioners. I mean, with all respect, I get vexed about a lot of things too, but you got to look and see what the law requires. That's what we're trying to figure out.
Right. And so, again, I would say, okay, I would concede that some degree of scienter is existent in the Virginia receipt of stolen property. What I would say in comparison to joyriding, Your Honors, is that the property itself doesn't require the conduct of that permanent deprivation of that. And that is why I would analog this to joyriding, is that this is a theft-like offense. I mean, it's itself in the Virginia statute listed as larceny. You have receipt of stolen property. You have burglary-type offenses, robbery-type offenses, theft, petty larceny, shoplifting. All of those are theft-like offenses, and historically, the board has always required the conduct to include permanent deprivation. And regarding the joyriding scenario, Your Honor, I mean, you end up, like we discussed in our brief and is discussed in the Ninth Circuit decision in Castillo-Cruz, that an individual who's in receipt of that car is then somehow more morally reprehensible of the individual who took the car. And so I think that's sort of the paradox and the juxtaposition that that is impossible for the board to reconcile in its own test.
What about matter of G? That the government relies on that and says you look at the original thief's intent, and that transfers over to the receiver from the original thief. That's a BIA decision, of course.
Yes, right. And again, I think I'm not disputing the intent requirement. I'm not disputing that they can have a different mens rea requirement. What I'm disputing is that conduct itself, that underlying conduct, still has to rise to the level that's morally reprehensible.
So you're past the intent to permanently deprive?
I'm not. I'm just saying I take Zarate's point that some of this stuff has been conflated. I think their intent to permanently deprive has to apply to the actual conduct as well, that there has to be that the conduct could include a permanent deprivation, like
the conduct of the petitioner.
The conduct of the statute, yes, Your Honor.
All right, but matter of G, the BIA says, no, what we really meant or mean is the conduct of the underlying thief transfers over. He has to have taken it with intent to permanently deprive, and then it goes over to the receiver.
Yes, sir.
Receiver.
And I understand that. I'm just saying, I don't think the board has consistently addressed the conduct. Even in the more recent sort of theft decision in the matter of Diaz-Lizarraga, you know, they changed the definition that they've had for 70 years. And they specifically contemplate in Diaz-Lizarraga that there would be temporary takings that wouldn't qualify as a CIMT. Yes, they start to include temporary takings all of a sudden, but those are temporary takings that substantially erode the value of the item. And so I think, given that the board, even at this stage, continues to contemplate temporary takings, and this statute, without a doubt, as listed in Baseman and the Virginia court decision, doesn't require that permanent deprivation. And so given that, I don't think that they can categorically qualify as a CIMT, Your Honor.
You obviously have an inside baseball knowledge of the way things work in the BIA, which I confess sometimes I get confused about. But how does a BIA panel bring about BIA en banc consideration if it can? How does the decisions get reconsidered by the entire BIA?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that that used to happen more frequently under different administrations. The BIA has not has just recently started having an oral argument again, and I don't understand, Your Honor, exactly the parameters in which they would join for an en banc decision, but even most of its published decisions, I can't tell you the last date that I've seen an en banc decision from the board, Your Honor.
And then you've got the Attorney General can superimpose his discretion on all of it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Statutory section. Here's what I'm driving at, and this is an outside baseball perspective. Why, you know about the ordinary remand rule and how strong that is, which is if you got a doubt about something or standards misapplied or this, that, or the other, you remand it to the administrative agency, don't do their business. And then you get the decision on remand clarifying whatever. Why couldn't we send it back to them and say, we're confused, and we want you to tell us in the first instance, face up to this issue, what is the BIA's position? And if you can't tell, then send it to the AG or do what you can to get some clarification.
I mean, that is what we're requesting, Your Honor, that it be remanded back to the board. I do agree.
I thought you were requesting we remand it to the board for the board to apply the facts to what you believe the standard is, intent to permanently deprive on the part of the receiver.
Well,
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you tell us what the standard is, BIA. Here's these decisions that says that. Here's matter of G. What are we talking about?
We are asking for remand on several grounds, Your Honor. One, I do think that the case law has required that permanent deprivation that I'm talking about, and I do believe that this is inconsistent with that. Two, I believe that, like in Zarate, this court could remand and say, do you find this minimum conduct rises to the level of vile, base, and depraved because you didn't include that in your analysis? Three, the last thing we're asking is a big ask, Your Honor. We're asking you to find that CIMT is void for vagueness in the non-fraud context.
Yeah, you keep slipping to number two. What about my proposal as for the first thing about what is required? What are the elements in a divisible statute that we have to have in order to justify? You don't get to the second requirement if it doesn't meet the first one. Don't be afraid to tell me I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, yes, Your Honor. I mean, I agree the court could do that. The only reason I'm sort of perplexed is because I think the BIA, if you look at the series of cases out of matter of Silva Trevino, I think they're battling themselves with how to define a CIMT. I mean, I think that's why this doesn't work.
Well, that rules out, that assumes they won't take it en banc, and I guess we don't know.
I would gladly take that, Your Honor, if you want to order the board to go en banc. I'm fine with that.
Yeah. And I just count the Court of Appeals decisions. You're not going to be fine with that.
I want to make sure I understand really specifically what you're saying the answer is. Is the issue that the board didn't specifically consider whether this conduct was vile and depraved, or is it that it didn't consider on the first prong whether an intent to deprive was part of the intent standard?
I think I would say both, Your Honor. I would say that historically it's very confusing whether the board has or has not also had an underlying intent to deprive requirement. But I would also say, given Zarate, Your Honor, that they never reached that second prong, and that second prong has also included conduct that includes permanent deprivation.
I thought I... Did our Zarate decision not take care of the second requirement? Why didn't it? I thought it held that was moral turpitude.
They never reached the second issue in Zarate, Your Honor. That's why they sent it back. They said intent to deceive, yes, first prong satisfied, but we still need to see whether that conduct is vile, base, or depraved.
All right. So the first issue's out?
For now. I mean, it was remanded. I'm not sure whether they'll take it back up, Your Honor.
All right.
And then you say that it would be vile, depraved, you know, whatever satisfied the second prong, if the statute does require intent to permanently deprive, but that it would not be if the statute does not require
I guess
intent to permanently deprive.
Your Honor asked me during day kind of where I would place the delta in day in the drug trafficking case, and I've thought about that a lot in preparing for this case. I mean, I would say that the board places the delta of the conduct at requiring permanent deprivation. That's not where I would place the delta, though, Your Honor. I mean, I just think wrong, morally wrong, as they call this in Solis Flores, means something significantly less than vile, base, or depraved. I just think that's a higher threshold, Your Honor.
So where would you set that threshold?
Personally, I don't think it would satisfy a legal standard. I would say
maybe something that's violent, or
I would say rape, arson, murder, child molestation, you know, burglary of a home at night. But that's why I think, again, this has gotten,
but not in the daytime.
If there's no way home and it's a pure property crime, personally, Your Honor, I'm not sure that I would say that's worth somebody not being admissible to the United States for the rest of their life, that that's worth banishing them or exiling them for the rest of their life. So I think I am comfortable in more violent situations and more serious crimes, but I think that there has to be a line somewhere, and I definitely wouldn't include shoplifting in it, but the board would.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Gordon.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, I'm Virginia Gordon on behalf of the U.S. Attorney General. Your Honors, the board has long held that the receipt of stolen property offense constitutes a crime involving moral turpitude when it requires that element that the recipient knows that the item has been stolen. And the discussion regarding the intent to permanently deprive has always been in the board's theft offense for a crime involving moral turpitude. And the board has kept these two categories of crimes involving moral turpitude separate. And the intent that is involved in the theft is not involved in the receipt because they are two different crimes. And as the court pointed out, we have several other circuit court of appeals, and even this court, who has applied that receipt of stolen property definition, generic definition, to an offense to find that it is a crime involving moral turpitude that renders the non-citizen either inadmissible, removable, or ineligible for
release. And that decision was in what case?
In Nasrallah, which was overruled on other grounds regarding the Convention Against Torture. But in the Nasrallah case, this court applied the receipt of stolen property definition to the conviction at issue there and found that it was a crime involving moral turpitude.
It was overruled on other grounds.
On other grounds, yes.
In a later decision, was it not?
The later decision does not change the crime involving moral turpitude.
I know, but it would if it got reversed, vacated, Supreme Court, or whatnot.
Right. And it is also done so in an unpublished decision, and I think the Solis Flores decision that recently came out from the Fourth Circuit explains well why the board's case law has consistently had this requirement for receipt of stolen property and did not include the intent to permanently deprive. And as Judge Carnes raised with the Matter of G case, I don't know if we read the board decision the exact same way, saying that it takes that intent to permanently deprive and sort of brings it over to the receipt of stolen property. We still see them as distinct, where a theft had to happen first. The property was stolen. The person who's convicted of the receipt of stolen property wasn't the thief, but they did receive that property knowing that it had been stolen. And so that's where we see the joyriding example being troubling, because we know that under the board case law, a joyriding isn't a theft. So if someone received a vehicle in that joyriding situation, well, a theft didn't happen, so it wasn't stolen, so they didn't receive stolen property. So it couldn't, a conviction couldn't be a receipt of stolen property in that example.
So you don't see the case law as being inconsistent? When you think of cases like, I think, Matter of G, Matter of K, Matter of S, as opposed to Matter of Surveil and Matter of Cerna, that there's nothing to be reconciled there?
I, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that the board certainly used some terminology that we could see as using that intent to permanently deprive language when it's talking in Matter of K about this German statute. And as we look at it, the German statute, the board was conducting its crime involving moral turpitude analysis, and it's looking at the statute that covers both knowledge that the property was stolen and an assumption based on given conditions that the item was acquired by means of any criminal act. And what the board saw there was that it just wasn't consistent with either an intent to permanently deprive, it didn't specifically say theft, but that's what it had applied to theft, or a knowledge that the property was stolen, because a person could gain that, not that item, with a good intent. So it mentions both, but it doesn't seem to do so in saying a receipt of stolen property has to have an intent to permanently deprive.
The good intent being, I'll take it back to the true owner?
Well, and that's not what the German statute has, but if a person's intent in receiving the stolen property was to return it to the true owner, then it probably wouldn't, at least under Virginia statute, wouldn't constitute a crime involving moral turpitude, because Virginia also has as an element a dishonest intent, and a dishonest intent is an intent to continue acting adversely to the owner's property interest. So under the Virginia statute, a person receives stolen property that was originally stolen. They know it was stolen. They receive it anyway, and they have a dishonest intent. They intend to adversely continue the adverse harm.
And so I thought the German statute in the matter of K, it may be founded upon the negligent receipt of property by a person acting in good faith. Isn't that the difference there? Right. That seems pretty different than the Virginia statute.
Right. It is, and that's why that couldn't be a receipt of stolen property offense under the board's definition, and why they found that it wasn't.
Now, it doesn't matter at this point, but I have real questions about the Mr. Rojas's lawyer's recommendation that he should take the plea agreement. That might have been a good solution for a U.S. citizen who wouldn't have immigration consequences. But, you know, it doesn't matter what the facts really show, because he pleaded to certain things, including knowledge. But that, you know, immigration cases are often hard, and that's what makes this one challenging, I think.
Yes, Your Honor, and I do understand that. And as you said, because we don't go back to the facts underlying conviction, we are stuck with the situation where we can only look at what the statute says and what the conviction record shows. And that certainly does, as you point out, raise these challenges. Because when we do that statute-to-statute comparison, this statute does meet the board's generic definition. And as the
Rati requires a one-step, two-step by the BIA for every single crime?
Well, the...
An explicit one-step, two-step?
The way it looks like what Zarate is saying is that if it's a non-fraudulent offense, then the board is going to have to say that there's a culpable mental state and there's reprehensible conduct, and follow its rule in matter of Silva Trevino. And one of our asks here is that the board has created these categories of crimes involving moral turpitude, such as theft and receipt of stolen property, where they say a theft has an intent to permanently deprive. That's a crime involving moral turpitude. Receiving stolen property must have the knowledge that the property was stolen. And those categories of offenses give us sort of a good window in, like, we have this category, it can be a crime involving moral turpitude.
But does the board need to say, and this is vile and depraved conduct because X?
That under Zarate, that's certainly the ideal, and that is what Zarate sent back, because the board didn't. But we believe that the receipt of stolen property does have both, because the culpable mental state is your knowledge that the property is stolen, and the reprehensible conduct is to receive it. And the Fourth Circuit sort of used that, saying, aside from any statutory prohibition, it is morally wrong to receive property knowing that it is stolen. So it does have both of those elements, but if the court were to feel they want it to specifically lay that out, there certainly is, as Judge Carnes pointed out, the opportunity to remand and ask the board to specifically delineate that receipt of stolen property, a category of crimes involving moral turpitude, does meet both the culpable mental state and the reprehensible conduct.
I understand the legal issue, but the mess of BIA decisions is another thing. Do you have anything to add with the opposing counsel on my own perplexity of trying to figure out what the en banc procedures of the BIA are?
I'm sorry to say, I don't know precisely the en banc procedures. I am aware informally from an appellate immigration judge recent presentation that board members will all sort of communicate together, here's this issue, it looks like it's percolating, it's an important issue of national importance, we should consider doing en banc, and they vote, and if the vote is enough, I'm not sure how many board members have to say yes, they will go to en banc. But that's...
Do they hear oral argument at en banc?
I think I have the same understanding as Mr. Osorio that they are starting to more often, but it is still not common practice to hear a lot of oral argument in the board. And they do have a heavy caseload. This doesn't justify it, but knowing their heavy caseload, that could be a reason, but I don't want to say that that's a reason.
Is there anything here for us to remand to this panel of the BIA and say clarify, confront?
I think if the court agrees that the receipt of stolen property category of crimes involving moral turpitude is sufficient, and the board has been clear over many years that that essential element is the knowledge of the stolen property, then there wouldn't be a reason to remand because the board has applied that definition here in this case. And because the Virginia statute is very clear that an essential element is that guilty knowledge, they are a categorical match.
Under your, I think, description of how the one step, two step would work here, would, since theft is kind of the first part of the balance for this statute, does that mean that receiving stolen property would be a crime of moral turpitude, but theft itself wouldn't be?
Well, that is where I don't think the board has specifically addressed that. I do know that under Virginia law, you couldn't get to receipt of stolen property if you didn't have a theft, because the Virginia definition of theft requires an intent to permanently deprive. So
on the front end.
Yes. So if there's not a theft, there's not a receiving stolen property because stolen property had an intent to permanently deprive. But that just happens to be the Virginia statute, and that's not how the board looked at it. The board simply looks at a person who receives stolen property knowing it was stolen has committed a crime involving moral turpitude. And I haven't seen, other than in the footnote in Matter of Cerna, where the board talks about possession of stolen goods with knowledge that they are stolen has long been held to be a CIMT, and then points out it's inherently wrong to deprive another of property by theft. Therefore, it is also wrong to receive that property knowing it is stolen. So it didn't lay out, that's certainly a footnote, and it didn't lay out that when it considers receipt of stolen property, it first looks for a theft. But it seems to be an understood, because how could one receive stolen property if there hadn't first been a theft?
But that's separate from then, is that behavior also reprehensible? That's a separate analysis, correct?
Yes, and our position is that to receive stolen property when you know it's stolen is reprehensible.
In and of itself. So there is no separate analysis because that initial finding covers the second required finding.
Right. Right. And I know in Zarate, the court said that we can't collapse the two elements, but one can inform the other. And so the knowledge that the property is stolen informs the fact that you have now received it knowing that it was stolen. That is reprehensible conduct. You could have chosen not to accept the stolen property into your possession.
Are there facts that would or could weigh into separating that out, that there's no question you received it, but then there's certain facts in the mix that would not make it reprehensible? I thought it was mine, I didn't know, found out later, or something else?
Well, under Virginia, I haven't seen cases where the board addresses that, but I've seen under Virginia law how they work with receiving stolen property offenses. So a defendant can put on a defense to this charge. And if the trier of fact believes it or finds it credible or there's enough there, they can accept it and not convict. Or if they find it to not be credible, they can use the presumption that the fact that you had it in your possession is enough to convict, or give the defendant an opportunity to put on more evidence to prove. If the defendant, his or her account of why this really wasn't knowing receipt of stolen property or it wasn't with dishonest intent convinces the trier of fact, it becomes the burden on the Commonwealth to disprove that and say, actually, no, the evidence shows that they didn't know. So they have that in Virginia, but I haven't seen the board address that with the generic CIMT definition.
And therefore, a finding that you received stolen property knowingly and then concluding that also means that behavior is reprehensible, as counsel stated, that essentially puts receipt of stolen property on par with murder or rape or arson. That seems pretty significant.
I don't know if I see it putting them on par. I do understand his point there. But the crime involving moral turpitude is an offense that, as we've talked about, is the inherently base, vile, or depraved conduct. And murder could fit in there, certainly, but it is inherently still base, violent, depraved, and contrary to accepted societal standards of how we treat one another. To steal, which is its own, which I'm sorry, is a different CIMT, or to receive property that has been stolen. So the certainly does fit a large category of offenses, but there certainly are offenses that won't be crimes involving moral turpitude. And I don't envision that every crime will be a crime involving moral turpitude simply because receiving stolen property.
I take it your position about that specific issue, it seems so much less bad than other crimes, is, if I may stretch the hypothetical, that just because mass murder is a terrible crime doesn't mean that assault is not a crime that meets the threshold of whatever the statute requires.
Yes, Your Honor. So that we have these offenses, and there are different levels of offenses, but because they meet these standards, they render a non-citizen removable or ineligible for relief under particular provisions. And I do see my time is up. So if there are no further questions, we ask the court to deny the petition for review. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Osorio.
I take Judge Karn's point that murdering 10,000 people is significantly worse than murdering one person, but I would still say that murdering one person qualifies as a CIMT. Where I think that has gotten blurred is, even in the different levels of theft offenses, we would say shoplifting a candy bar is significantly less bad than robbing a bank. And so, again, vile, base, and depraved, morally reprehensible, to me means something different than just wrong. I think driving a car while intoxicated is wrong, but we say that's not a CIMT. I think, you know, speeding at 150 miles an hour down the highway is a CIMT. It, to me, is morally reprehensible when you're putting people's lives at risk, but we say that's not a CIMT. So I think, again, where it's kind of gotten lost for me is where we're placing that line. Regarding the governor's position on the reprehensible conduct being receiving it, that conflicts with the board's own case law in matter of Cerna. Because in matter of Cerna, you have an individual who is possessing, so clearly received, fraudulent immigration documents. And they said, well, we need that aggravating factor. We need an intention to use it. There has to be something more. Just possessing fraudulent immigration documents is insufficient in that case. Again,
but here there was an intent to use it. Was there not?
There was no intent to deprive. There was no intent to use. There was no. I mean, I guess if we're arguing just possession alone is sufficient.
But didn't in the matter of Cerna note that the possession of stolen goods or mail with the knowledge that they are stolen is a crime of moral turpitude, and then it raises a different distinction?
It does, Your Honor. I guess that's my sort of main issue, is that I don't see the distinction. And even in that footnote, it then ties it back to, you know, a theft case that it has to be tied to a theft case with a permanent intention to deprive. So that I guess that's where I find fault with the logic in matter of Cerna, is that you're saying that the actual person taking it has to have an intent to deprive, and the other person could keep it with an intention to give it back, and they would still be morally culpable because they knew that it was stolen. I mean, morally culpable, yes, but morally reprehensible just because they possessed something they knew to be stolen, even if they had an intent to return it. And I also think this court's case in Lopez, you know, when this court found that 1956A1, where individuals knowingly engaging in financial transactions derived from illicit activities, was not categorically a CIMT. No.
That's only because, trust me, if the portion of for the purpose of avoiding a reporting requirement was not in that statute, at least for my purposes, that's a crime of moral turpitude all day long. But to do something for purposes of avoiding a reporting requirement is different in nature than to do something with the purpose to deceive someone. So that, for me at least, speaking only for myself, is a pretty fundamental distinction in Lopez that we don't have here.
Your Honor, I would just say that I think structuring, to me, if I'm structuring bank accounts to avoid reporting the requirement, is, to me, more morally reprehensible than somebody possessing an item less than worth a penny without an intention to deprive. And I guess that.
What about possessing the Hope Diamond without intent? See, the problem with all these hypotheticals is there was a case. Don't remember case names as well as I used to, but it was before the Supreme Court on either aggravated felony or crime of violence for all these similar purposes. And the Supreme Court said, look, let's get out of this crazy hypothetical thing. We're talking about the norm of these cases. And the norm is nobody gets arrested or deported for a penny. Or for shoplifting, for that matter, unless it's you're shoplifting a new car.
I agree, Your Honor, but under the categorical approach, we have to look at the minimum conduct. And since the Virginia contemplates...
No, but looking at the minimum conduct in that case, that decision, Supreme Court, by majority, said you don't look at bizarre hypotheticals to say, well, they could be covered, even though they're almost never prosecuted.
Well, Virginia did prosecute, and we pointed to that Wolverton case, Your Honor, where it was a lock worth 30 cents. That's a larceny case. And so I think there is, you know, both a realistic probability in the statute and in the case law that they would prosecute something of a
realistic probability, more than 50% chance on a 30% theft that they're going to prosecute.
It was 1881, Your Honor. So 30 cents problematic. But we can still point to it, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question on a different note before you sit down? Do you know if Mr. Rojas could seek a waiver under INA Section 212H? Are you familiar with that section?
Yes, Your Honor.
If he would.
There's some issues, as the court can see through both our briefing and the government's briefing. He's trying to resolve the Interpol red notice in Peru. And so
that's a complicating factor.
Potentially consular process, but that requires him to leave the United States, return to Peru to do the consular processing at the U.S. Embassy.
I see.
So until that issue is resolved. So that's sort of the preventive factor. I mean, to be blunt, it is a potential opportunity in the future should this court decide against him. But he would have to actually do an I-601 for the CIMT, Your Honor, and so that's a longer waiver and would require him to be probably outside the United States right now about 3 years and away from his family during that time period.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
That is our last case of the day. We appreciate counsel's oral arguments. We hope everyone has a safe trip home, and this court is adjourned.
All right.